It's uncomfortable, it's downright awful, and I guarantee you don't want to talk about it. But we have to. January is Human Trafficking Prevention Month, and we continue our conversation today discussing this issue here in our state and how we can educate ourselves and even our kids about the dangers of trafficking. This time yesterday morning on WICC, we spoke with Jamie Manarikiza with the nonprofit organization Partnerships to End Human Trafficking, also known as PET. And we learned that PET is actually teaming up with different agencies, including the Rowan Center, to specifically educate students, parents, and teachers about the problem of trafficking. And so today we're talking to the director of education at the Rowan Center. Sarah Malhotra is here. And Sarah, welcome to WICC. I am really glad that you are joining in on this conversation to educate our listening audience. We appreciate it. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much, Melissa, for having me. It's really a great way to, you know, get to talk to everyone about this, because like you said earlier, this wasn't defined by the United Nations until, you know, 2000. So when people learn about it, they really are like, how come I didn't know about it? And it's like, well, we've defined sexual assault, sexual abuse for many decades. This is fairly new in its definition.
And we don't really think it exists here. You know, we hear about it in the news. We see about these stories like a Jeffrey Epstein and we think, oh, that's awful. And we watch a documentary, but we think, well, that's not actually happening here in Fairfield County, for example. But it is.
Yeah. And when people think trafficking, a lot of people will think like the movie Taken or Liam Neeson situations. When really like trafficking is almost like a misnomer, people just really think displacement. But really like the definition is it's like what was said yesterday. Any sort of, you know, sexual exploitation of a minor in exchange for goods, whether it's money, whether it's clothing, a ride home, alcohol, drugs, that is already considered sex trafficking.
Well, that's just it. I think that we have this depiction in our brains and it doesn't match up with what is actually happening, at least here in the States in some regards and here in Connecticut. But exactly that. Sometimes it may even seem like the victim doesn't realize they're a victim. I mean, you're talking about high schoolers, even college age students who are willingly giving their bodies in exchange for goods and they don't realize that they are being trafficked. So I think that's one of the biggest concerns that we see is that we as a public don't really understand and embrace what the definition is of human trafficking and sex trafficking. And we also don't, I don't know if we want to believe that this is going on here, but it is. And so we've made it a point here on the show, as has your agency and many other nonprofits in our state, to really make sure people understand the reality in 2024 of human trafficking and also what we can do to combat it. So first of all, let's back up a quick second. I know you're the director of education at the Rowan Center. What is the Rowan Center? And you're based in Stamford, correct?
Correct. So we are a member center that is part of the Alliance to End Sexual Violence. So we are a member center, like there's nine of us that cover all of Connecticut. So we cover, we're a 24-hour crisis center, right? So we cover our 24-hour crisis hotline. We have education services. So I do education, prevention education for like K through 12, parents, students, really anyone that is available to learn about sexual violence so that we can hopefully prevent it in the future. We offer counseling services. So we have free crisis counseling available to primary and secondary victims of sexual violence so we can help folks that dealt with sexual violence in the past. And then we also do advocacy services. So we see people at Stamford Greenwich Norwalk Hospital for hospital accompaniment should they need a safe kit or a rape kit. We go to police departments and help people file instances of sexual violence, and we also offer emotional support at court should people need it.
So let's talk about the education portion of this, Sarah, because I think that's what's really interesting. I didn't even realize that this was something that was being discussed in our public schools. What does that curriculum look like? You know, when you go into the schools and talk about this with students, for example, what are you saying?
We're really like at the elementary school level, we're teaching about like bodily autonomy and boundaries, respecting like each other's boundaries. So even between peers, them understanding something as simple as, hey, make sure you ask your friend if they want a hug. You know, understanding that people need permission to be able to touch people's bodies. the very, you know, basic kind of showing respect to other people, asking permission. And that can really start a good conversation of as students get older, also understanding what boundaries adults need to have with them. Because it's really tough. I think even 10 years ago when I was starting to do this work, it was very like tell students to protect themselves against adults. But how do we expect a 5 or an 8 year old or a 10 year old to fight an adult if they are being if their boundaries are being crossed? So really it's on, you know, getting them to understand how to report and how to recognize that something is wrong, something is unhealthy, and something's unfair, and to be able to like connect to their safety team and kind of identify who is my safety team, what is a safe adult, who can I, you know, really go to for help.
And I could see, Sarah, where you would need to also have parents involved in this. And again, we have Sarah Malhotra here, who is the director of education at the Rowan Center based in Stamford, a nonprofit organization. And this agency will literally go into schools and will teach kids about, you know, the rights of their body and having boundaries with other peers and with other people. The reason I think that parents need to be involved not only is because they should know what their kids are being taught, but parents sometimes don't realize that they are putting their kids in an uncomfortable position. There's nothing more uncomfortable for me. And look, I grew up Italian, okay? I came from a big Italian family where you hugged and you kissed everybody, strangers, all that. But, you know, I've realized that even, you know, as I had my own child, that we can't be forcing our kids just because it's a friend of mine from work and I know them very well. If my kid doesn't know that person, I'm not going to force my kid to hug you. I'm not going to force my kid to hug an aunt who he's only met once in his life and he doesn't remember it. Because if he doesn't feel comfortable or he doesn't know you and he doesn't trust you, we need to respect our kids and not give them contradictory lessons in respecting their bodies and respecting their needs, correct? I mean, I think that's why you have to have parents on board for that alone.
Yeah, it's really, you're absolutely right. Because again, what are the lessons we're teaching and instilling in young people, right? If you're telling a kid, yes, people need to respect your body, but certain adults can tell you what to do with your body, even if you don't want to, that is going to make your child more vulnerable. So saying things like, you know, making sure they understand people need to ask you, I want to make sure that you are feeling comfortable and you feel in control when it regards your body. Right. If it's to keep you clean and healthy, we talk about the clean and healthy rule all the time. Like if it's to keep you clean or healthy, like, yes, you need to take a bath. Yes, you need to eat your vegetables. Yes, you need to, you know, certain medical things you might need to do in
you
order
to
stay healthy and
body.
Alive.
Right.
But, you know, if it's not a matter of life or death if you do not hug your aunt or uncle, you know what I mean? But so in that case, it's like letting your child have that decision making is really going to set them up to understand when there is an adult who tries to cross that boundary, they will hopefully be able to, but also feel comfortable telling you like, hey, mom, hey, dad, like this person made me feel really unsafe. And, you know, having that open dialogue and constant conversation.
We're talking to Sarah Malhotra, who is the director of education at the Rowan Center based right here in Stamford. And we're discussing human trafficking, sex trafficking, because it does exist here in Connecticut. It is a problem. And so Sarah was just talking about how they've created at the Rowan Center some curriculum to bring into schools and teach students, teachers, and parents about trafficking and just simple things like how to respect our bodies and how to respond to people and also create boundaries within ourselves, our peers, whatever. Here's my question for you, Sarah, because we started to get into this with Jamie when we were talking about partnerships to end human trafficking. I know Jamie isn't a teacher or a counselor, but I had said to her, you know, one of the things that's very alarming, and we learned this kind of with the Jeffrey Epstein situation and some of the documentaries that came out afterwards, is that you've got high schoolers, college-age students who actually get involved with human trafficking or sex trafficking, and then they become recruiters. They don't realize sometimes that they're recruiting people, but they go to school. They're like, hey, I've got this friend. Oh, my gosh, you can make a ton of money if you just do this. And all of a sudden, your kid gets involved with this because it's a friend of theirs who's recruiting them, or it's somebody a peer that they go to school with or a very smart person in their classroom, and they think, okay, sure, I could check this out. Or they're at a party. They're simply at a party. They're a bystander. They don't even realize that they're getting involved with this, and all of a sudden they've come across it. How do you address that? How do you teach at the high school level, you know, some of the things to look out for in reporting potential human or sex trafficking?
So I actually have a really interesting story to kind of highlight like what this kind of could look like. So I actually have a coworker who at the time had a 14-year-old daughter who was approached in school by a friend of a friend saying, hey, like, there's this party that, you know, my family is hosting in like Rye, New York, I believe, or some place in New York, just across the border. And, you know, they're looking for people, you know, some people to like pay to like just pass out food, kind of like a catering gig. You'll get like $200 or $300 cash at the end of the day. You know, it's just a family party. Do you want to come over and do that?
Sounds harmless, right? Right.
Sounds harmless. It sounds too good to be true. Mm-hmm. But thank goodness, like, you know, my coworkers in this work, and even, you know, when her daughter approached her and was like, hey, like, this sounds like a really great opportunity. It's cash. It's like, you know, but even parents might even say like, you know, especially if you are someone that's like, oh, the money would be really great, or it's a friend, so it's a family party. What's the harm in that? But right then and there, the big red flag should be, why is an adult trying to pay a child to do an adult job?
Mm-hmm.
Why, like, when it sounds too good to be true, and that's what try and really teach young people, middle schoolers, high schoolers, like, if it sounds too good to be true, then we need to, like, really take inventory of that. Because what's going to happen is the first time they go to the party, nothing's going to happen. They could be going, oh, it's going to be successful. They get the $200 then. Come back in 2 weeks, do it again. Come back in another 2 weeks, do it again. And nothing bad, quote unquote, might not happen until they're really in it.
And
then
trust
it turns
them.
Into,
now
you know,
I know
right.
them. There's no question about it. My parents are good with it. That's just it. Right.
Right. And so it can be as innocuous and as tiny as that and then just build. So that's why even when you mentioned earlier, like people, middle schoolers, high schoolers, young people don't really realize they are victims in this. And really in their mind, it's like, no, I'm choosing to do this. I'm in control. I don't see myself as a victim, which then can be really hard for teachers that are involved, school officials, because they really are at a loss of like, I'm trying to help this kid, but they're not letting me help them, when really the child is going to say, please leave me alone. Like, I'm making money. Get out of my way.
So that's a really tricky thing. So it's a combination of making sure that students really understand the risks, but also making sure that you've got, I know we put a lot on teachers, but I think we actively need to put it on parents, really, to monitor your kids. Don't really care if you've got to go back to old school ways of parenting, which is, you know, checking their phones, for example. You probably pay for them, so check the phones. Maybe going back to the old school, I need to call this friend's parent to make sure I understand, you know, this party you're going to. I mean, do you suggest that, Sarah? What are some things that you tell the parents?
I really do. With the parents, I want to inform them of, like, you might not be aware, but this is what trafficking can look like. What's awful is that in Connecticut, too, they're showing, the stats are showing that 67% of the people that have been trafficked in Connecticut, the young people, were still living at home while being trafficked. So this is happening even while students are attending school. You know, they maybe tell parents, hey, I'm going to go to a sports thing, but really they're going to a motel party with a bunch of adults that, you know, they had no idea that the child would even have a ride to this. But really also I'm trying to encourage parents to have open conversations, similar to like, if you want to teach your child about, you know, the really harmful things around drugs, fentanyl, anything like that, having a conversation. I really believe knowledge is power. Having really good conversations, age-appropriate conversations about it, to be like, this is why I'm concerned. This is why I'm worried. This is why this is so dangerous. You know, I really need you to know that no matter what, you can talk to me. And you know, I think even we take a step back, talking about sex or sexuality is so difficult and so awkward. And people are afraid, if I talk to my kid about sex, they're going to engage in sex. And that's not the case. There's actually a study from 2021 that shows that comprehensive sex education and consent education actually delays sexual debut. So I think we just need to really open the conversation and not be afraid to do that.
Right. I think even that is logical. You know, like when kids aren't curious or kids don't feel like they're rebelling, and they feel like, okay, I understand it, I get it. You know, some of the mystery alone makes them delay saying, okay, I know what this is about, or I understand the purpose of this. And so they delay wanting to do that. I think that's just logical. Sarah, I am curious, because we've run out of time, but if people want to get advice or they want to learn more about this curriculum, is there a way that they can contact the Rowan Center? Is there a way that they could get some of this information? It's super important.
Oh, absolutely. So you can find us at therowancenter.org. You can follow us on Instagram. Our handle is therowancenter. We have all our prevention education on there, and people can email us through our website and request education. We're able to offer it to anyone that's within Greenwich, Stamford, Norwalk, New Canaan, Wilton, Weston, Westport, Gary Ann. But even if they're outside that area, if they contact us, we will definitely connect you with the right people in your area.
Well, I really appreciate everything that you've shared this morning, Sarah, and we certainly will be sharing it with our listeners on our podcast, WICC600.com. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Take care.
All right. And again, Sarah Malhotra is the Director of Education at the Rowan Center in Stamford, and some really great information from her. And again, if you want to learn more, you can always go to therowancenter.org. It's all spelled out, therowancenter.org.
Family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help. Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
It's all about putting yourself in someone else's shoes. Over the weekend, as you know, we were really excited in our household to see finally some snow fall. It has felt like too long of a time. In almost a year, we finally experienced our first snowfall in Connecticut in this past weekend. Interestingly enough, though, as we were enjoying the snow and playing outside, I had a lot of emails that came in. They were all very nice, but they were people who were saying, Melissa, this is awful. I hate this. I do not enjoy this. I am not happy about this. And whether it was snowing outside, or whether it felt like it was cold out there, or whether it just felt like there's really no life outside, it feels dark, it feels eerie. This is sort of the time of year where people experience what is commonly known as the winter blues. So how do we get through this season, but also not just, you know, push through, try to enjoy the time that we do have on this earth, even if it includes the winter season in Connecticut. And so we wanted to talk about not staying stuck in handling maybe seasonal depression with our morning show counselor, Julius Dudix, who is here right now. Good morning, Julius. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me back. Yeah. Seasonal affective disorder, SAD, or seasonal depression affects so many. And sometimes the best thing that these people did was they wrote in and they began to acknowledge, mm-hmm. Hey, you know what? The snow triggered something in me. And now I've got the winter blues. It doesn't mean you're abnormal, because there are so many on different levels face the winter blues or seasonal depression. And, you know, like with any, we always talked about any type of psychological disorder or any type of mental disorder, it doesn't mean that you're weird or you're a weirdo. It just means you got a broken arm and you're trying to acknowledge it and you want to fix it. And there's a spectrum. You know, some people can really have significant seasonal depression and be high on the spectrum. Some people can be moderate. Some people can be low on the spectrum. So the first thing is that it's normal to feel that way. What my concern is when it begins to affect your day-to-day living, and it's the oppressive thought of, oh, I can't get out of bed. You know, I just can't do life. I'm not sleeping well. I'm not eating well. I'm not exercising. I'm not taking care of myself. You know, that's what my concern is. But seasonal depression, the only thing we can say about seasonal depression is, you know, it's coming. You know, you mm-hmm. can prepare for it. Because most people, it affects most people. January and February are the most difficult months for many.
Well, Julia, so some of the things that you just pointed out are kind of obvious signs, right? I'm not eating. I don't have any motivation. I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to do things. Okay, so those are pretty obvious signs. What I find is interesting is a lot of times people can say that they love the winter. They love the snow. They love the seasons. Sure. That's why I live in New England, right? But they don't realize that they actually have mood swings, that it does impact their way of thinking or their tolerance levels for people, or how engaged they are, or how motivated they are to go out and enjoy a weekend, you know, away doing something or whatever. How do you detect that you have any kind of seasonal, I'm going to call it mood swings, because it may not be depression. Yeah. It may just be something that really alters the way that you typically get through your day to day.
Yeah, well, for seasonal depression, if it occurs similarly the same time for at least 2 to 3 years, then you know that, hey, you know, every January for the past 2, 3 years or 4 years, I kind of go into this rut. That's, you know, how you kind of identify that. But if you're having difficulty concentrating, remembering details, making decisions, if you're tired a lot, if you're feeling inordinate guilt or hopelessness or pessimism, or you're irritable or you're moody, or you don't really find interest in hobbies and activities that typically you once found enjoyable, even aches or pains, or overeating or not eating enough. But persistent, sad, anxious, empty thoughts, it may mean that you're wrestling with some type of depression. And Melissa, again, you could be low on that spectrum or you could be high on that spectrum. And we all wrestle, you know, with, you know, I don't want to get out of bed this morning. Mm-hmm. But if that becomes a reoccurring repetitive pattern, then you need to really take a look at yourself and say, what can I do about it? And first of all, I should talk to my general practitioner, my doctor, let him know how I'm feeling. Again, the best thing these people did, they called in. They said, hey, Melissa, you know, this triggered something in me. And true, sometimes there are triggers to depressive thought. You know, it could be death in the family. It could be loss of a relationship, but there's so many triggers. You've just got to know yourself and be honest with yourself.
Yeah, and again, we have Julius Dudix here, who's our morning show counselor. I actually just got a message as we're speaking saying, wow, this sounds like me. And look, I think that's the first thing, is to recognize that this could be you. I noticed for the first time this year, Julius, it's interesting. So I always was a winter lover. I grew up a skier.
Yeah.
Heck, I went to school in Vermont. So I lived like basically right outside of Canada on and off for 10 years. So I've always known that I like the wintertime. But it's interesting, this year for the first time, that stretch between Christmas and New Year's when my son was off from school, I don't know if you remember that week of weather. It was gray. It was cold. Mm-hmm. The sun never came out. And it didn't really rain, but it just was blah outside. It was depressing, to be honest. Like, to put it simply, it felt very depressing. And I felt for about 4 days straight, I wasn't myself. I thought, what is going on? Nothing really has changed. You know, the same level of chaos that's always there, the same level of stuff that's happening. And I've always managed it very well. And it was by about the fourth or fifth day that I realized I came to work. And when I walked out of work that day, I thought, do you think the sun could just come out? Or do you think I could at least see some color, a pop of color? And I said that out loud. And I said to myself, oh, my gosh, is this why I felt off all week? And I had never felt that way before. So my question for you is it possible to also, as you get older, shift your thinking? Something that used to be great maybe isn't as great as it used to be anymore.
Yeah, you can go through that shift in thinking, and before you know it, if you're not careful, that will define who you are and how you feel about life.
Mm.
And that's where you really have to be honest with yourself and surround yourself with some good people who you can talk to. Be with people. Don't isolate. I always, you know, when I hear people are depressed, I sit down with them, and I one of the first things I'll typically ask is, hey, what brings you joy? You know, it's a gray day outside. It's going to rain in the afternoon. It's going to torrential rain. But, you know, hey, what brings you joy?
Mm.
And typically it tells me a lot about a person, because there are some people who just have such difficulty saying, you know what, I've got some friends that I really like to connect with. Or you know, I enjoy watching the New York Giants, or they're not doing that well this year. They didn't do well at all.
That's depressing in itself, but okay.
That's depressing.
That's a whole different seasonal depression.
There are some people that can never answer that question. What brings me joy?
Mm.
So in order to, you know, help yourself with the depressive thought, with the seasonal depression, hey, ask yourself, hey, what really brings me joy? Do something for somebody else. Buy some flowers. You know, light therapy. I was thinking about how to help people with seasonal depression. You know, there are certain light therapies that really can help. Make sure you're sitting in a room that is well lit. You know, even if it's a gray day, make sure it's kind of airy. Make sure that You know, there's also B12, vitamin B12, vitamin D. See your doctor. You know, get some blood work done. Make sure that those levels are okay. But, you know, it's all about acknowledging. It's all about asking yourself, do I really want to be this way? And what can I do to help myself? But ultimately, depression, there's a great quote that I share. It's like a bruise that never goes away. Mm. It's a bruise in your mind. And you have to be careful not to touch it where it hurts. But it's always there. Mm-hmm. And so you just kind of learn coping skills, coping mechanisms to deal with the depression, because it does affect people.
The winter blues, seasonal depression, whatever you want to call it. Some Connecticut residents, maybe yourself, feeling like you're going through that for January and February. And so how do we cope with this time of the year? And we have Julia Zdudix here, our morning show counselor, who is a firm believer in not staying stuck. And we want to make sure that we don't do that this winter. What do you think about journaling, Julius? I know you started to talk about some coping mechanisms. And the reason I ask about journaling is because I think that's become very popular for a lot of people, meditating, journaling. But the reason I question journaling is because sometimes you can spiral in a journal. I mean, it could be very therapeutic, but sometimes you can almost stay, you know, I know you hate this, but you could almost stay stuck in your bad thoughts, and then you're sort of staying in your own mind, you're isolating more. So what do you think about journaling?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it could have a negative or a positive effect. Mm-hmm. If you find yourself negatively going down one of those dark roads, or hopping in one of those dark rabbit holes, you've got to stop yourself. And then you've got to say, you know, do I have a trusted friend around I can share this with? There's got to be somebody that I can share these deep, dark thoughts with. And that's how to begin to address, as a coping skill, develop healthy relationships. There's so much to be said, and it could be a professional, or it could be just a friend, an aunt or an uncle or a grandmother or grandfather, somebody you trust. But if you're writing dark, deep, deep things, you got to acknowledge it and say, hey, listen, it's not going to help me to just keep it to myself. So in other words, be open with people. And again, don't isolate in those. So, yes, Melissa, it is very good to journal. But you've got to be careful that the journaling is productive and not counterproductive in terms of keeping you down.
That makes a lot of sense. Something else that you really pointed out there is that, I mean, depending on what gives people energy or what makes them happy, it sounds like you don't want to isolate. So one of the things, you know, you were saying is, it seems like social connection. How do you create social connection, though, when people have busy schedules, or maybe it's hard to travel, or it's hard to get to the people you want to see? You know, is that a matter of scheduling Zoom meetings or making a pen pal? Like, what do you suggest to avoid social isolation?
Yeah, be intentional. Really be intentional. And find most people have two or three people they can confide in. And if you don't, then you've got to really be intentional about finding two or three people that I really can confide in and say, hey, listen, I'm just not doing well. Mm-hmm. And there's something about being vulnerable, and there's something about being humble and being open with somebody else that really builds relationship. Mm-hmm. Because that individual may be suffering from seasonal depression or some type of depression as well. But be intentional, number one, about seeking help. And sometimes, too, you almost have to push yourself to do things for other people. To get out of your own head and to say, you know, who can I call today? Who could I encourage today? You know, how can I put a smile on my face? Melissa, there's so much to be said for a simple smile. I mean, you smile a lot, right?
I do. It's obnoxious. I can't help it. My face, I think, just does that. I don't know.
You just tend to be happier when you smile, but there are people that walk around. You can see them in a grocery store. You see them in the stores. Mm. I mean, it's called a big pickle puss. And you know what?
I didn't know that's what it was called. Now I know.
There's something about telling yourself, hey, I'm going to smile. Mm. I'm going to push myself, force myself to smile. And I'm going to also force myself to a big, huge, huge piece of, I think, recovery is exercise. Pushing myself to get my serotonin levels. Because, again, you know, you talk about treating depressive disorder. You can go to your general practitioner or psychiatrist, I'm sorry, Trintellix, Remeron, Cymbalta, those types of things, they have a place to balance those synaptic fluids in your brain. And that's something under the care of, a psychiatrist would be helpful,
right.
too.
Right. It might be good, again, if this is something more severe than just kind of going through mood swings. Like I said, when I realized that a couple weeks ago for myself, I thought, oh, maybe I don't see winter the way I did. I overall really like it, and I definitely get energy from it. But I think the mild winters these past couple of years, actually, it's sort of depressing to me. Like, I love living in New England, but to not have white winters and to just kind of be in these either wet or blah or gross winter seasons is not really the same as what I remember them being. And when I realized that, you know, some of the things that we talked about today, making sure that I'm intentionally calling, for example, you know, my sisters or something who really are uplifting, or like you said, going out and buying flowers. That's exactly what I went and did when I realized I haven't seen a pop of color. It felt like in 2 weeks. I went out and I bought myself some flowers and I put them in the house and I opened up
Good
the windows.
For you.
Yeah, well, you know what, Julius? I learned a couple things from, you know, working with you over the years. So I think, you know, but if it goes beyond some of these little coping mechanisms, it might be a good idea to go and see someone professional. It could be Julius or someone else. But Julius, if people do want to connect with you about this, where do they go?
They can look at my website online. It's N as in Nancy, J as in John, cc.online. Or they can call the office at 203-243-7714. I find it interesting, though, light therapy was huge in terms of just a remedy, a coping skill. And, you know, the interesting thing about light therapy is we all love light.
Yes.
But who's the author of light? There's a God above who is pure light. And when we look at his face and look at his presence and his grace and his greatness, man, that light can really encourage us as well.
True.
So a lot of it has to do with your faith.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's true, too. That's a really good point. Julius, I always appreciate that we have you in our corner. Thank you so much, and we'll tackle something else next week.
Thanks for all you do, Melissa. Have a good day.
You too. Julius Dudix, our morning show counselor here on WICC. Here we go again. We've got another rainstorm coming our way within the next 24 hours, and so we know flooding is a huge concern. But on top of that, we also are just in the winter months, and typically in Connecticut, this is when we start to see leaks happen, pipes burst, things like that. And so we have our friends at Tri-City here to talk about everything you should be thinking about for this storm and even going forward into the winter season. Amanda is with us back in studio. Hey, Amanda, how are you?
Hi, good morning.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having me.
Are you guys super busy?
Super busy.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
Yeah. What have you been going through, I'll even say since December, because it's been a really wet couple of months in Connecticut.
I mean, the weather has been so weird.
Yeah.
Right? It's been crazy. So obviously right now we're just getting into those really cold nights where, you know, your stuff is running all night long. So we're really getting those no heat calls. And then we're seeing a lot of flooding, doing a lot of sump pumps. So with the heavy rains that we've had, and then, like, of course, today we're going to have the winds and the heavy rains. You know, sometimes when people lose power, their sump pump goes down, and that's really what keeps that water from rushing into their foundations and their basements. So that's a lot of the stuff that we see with this kind of weather.
So obviously, I don't know, as you're kind of overloaded with calls right now, it may be hard in the next few hours to get some of the mitigations needed to avoid some of those problems. But what would you recommend homeowners to do to avoid flooding issues in the future?
Yeah, definitely checking on those items before the storm. So if you know that you have a sump pump in your home, just testing it, making sure that it's plugged in, that it's operating. And then checking it every couple hours during the storm to make sure that it is working, in fact. And we do have plumbers on call and on standby. So if someone does have an emergency and their pump isn't working, we can most likely get someone out there.
Yeah, shout out to Steve because he helped me out a couple weeks ago with Tri-City. And that was literally a phone call to you guys. And I think 20 minutes later, he said, I'm doing a call not too far away from you, so I'll come visit you and go back to this call. I mean, you guys are very accommodating at Tri-City. Amazing.
So the thing about plumbing is that what we've really realized is that, like, when you need a plumber, you usually find out at that exact moment.
Exactly.
It's not something that you necessarily like plan for.
Right.
It's just like all of a sudden there's water and you need a plumber.
Exactly.
So we really try to accommodate customers and get somebody out right away to at least stop the water, you know, try to lower the damage, get some damage control going on, and then assess the problem.
Yeah, and again, we have Amanda here with Tri-City, and we are going into yet another flood concern in Connecticut. We've just had so much water, it feels like, in the last few months. And so I know you guys are bogged down. I was telling our listeners that we had a leaking situation a couple weeks back in our home, and the insurance companies say they're getting hundreds of claims per week over the last couple of months. It's just insane between flooding and leaks. Let's talk about it for flooding really quick before we change to leaking situations. How important it is to have a professional to come out sooner rather than later, that you're not just walking through those waters by yourself. I mean, I would think you would want a professional to really check that situation before even a homeowner dives in deep, essentially.
So if you start noticing that water is coming in before it gets to the point where you're, you know, knee deep in water, you do want to make sure that you shut down any electrical items that are down there that are on that level. Obviously move anything that you can move out, you know, to...
Should probably do that today.
Yeah. Now.
Mm-hmm. Do
that
it
would
now.
Be now.
Yeah. Right. That would be this moment, please.
I think the weather's going to start this afternoon, you know, so now would be the time to kind of check out the situation. If you have anything that's in danger, that's, like, plugged in, that's in danger of getting wet, definitely unplug it. That will, you know... hopefully help with not short-circuiting anything.
And then with
you don't want to like dive in there if you have like, you know, inches of water, just go walking into it. Definitely
right.
not.
Well, because you don't know what's floating around there. And even just like sharp items, or you don't know if anything, you know, spilled. Like you just don't. I don't know. I think that just sounds
electrocuted.
Yeah, that certainly is. It would be a disaster as well. And so, you know, talking about even leaks, for example, is another one. Is there a way to mitigate the situation? Let's say you call in. So like my situation, for example, we had a toilet overflowing.
Okay.
And thankfully, Steve, the plumber, was able to come out within 20 minutes. Thank you again, Steve. We appreciate you. But sometimes, you know, again, when you're getting bogged down with so many calls, especially after a storm, you know, what if Steve couldn't come for 5 or 6 hours? Do I have options, or what are things I should be thinking about to shut the water off or to mitigate the situation?
Exactly. You want to get a shutoff valve. You want to have a shutoff valve that's accessible, that you know where it is. Most people probably have one in the home, so it could just be a matter of when you have a plumber there asking him, hey, do I have a shutoff valve? Could you label it and mark it for me? So,
but you can install one?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Easily.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Can I have a bunch?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Multiple. Yeah.
Many much
shutoff valve for each bathroom, for each. I mean, you can have one for every fixture if you really want to get.
I'm tempted.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. I have quite a few.
Do you?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I like to have control, you know, over the water and, well, over all of the systems in my home.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, though, is again, and you're a professional, you're in this industry. So to me, I think if you've got these shutoff valves, I think the everyday person probably should, or at least be able
to locate.
At least
one or two, or be able to locate it. Yeah. I mean, it's nice to have one at really important junctures in the home so that you can just turn it off if you have an issue. It also makes it easier to work on it if you can isolate it. You know, the more you know about your home system, the more you're going to be able to avoid these huge catastrophes just by being able to, you know, control what's going on in your home.
Yeah. And again, we have Amanda here with Tri-City, and we want to make sure that you're as prepared as possible for the upcoming storm. And it does sound like even though it's going to be a mild winter, we are going to continue to see these kinds of rainstorms and windstorms. I know that they're expensive as well. I mean, I don't know if you guys sell the generators.
We
but
do.
That might be another thing that people need to think about long-term investing in, because like you said, Paul was talking on the show earlier that we're going to see the worst of the storm between like 11 p.m. and 3 a.m.
Yeah.
which, okay, so power shuts down, your sump pump stops working, and now all of a sudden you're out cold, and you're not going to notice the problem until 7-8 hours later.
Yeah.
So to have that backup generator really, you know, yes, it's a lot of money up front to pay for a generator, but in the long run, when you look at the mitigation, the drying out, the replacement, and everything.
And the convenience, Melissa. When you,
right.
when everybody loses power and your home instantly, you don't even know. It
right.
just switches right over. It automatically transfers power from the generator, and you're running as if nothing is going on.
Yeah.
So, and you know, yes, they are an investment, but we have amazing financing that customers can utilize.
Oh, you do?
We do, yeah. And putting in a generator is something that, you know, it really gives you peace of mind when these storms are being forecasted and you're hearing about these winds and people losing power. It's so nice to have that. So that backup source of power. And, you know, with everything going electric, so right now there's a lot of talk about, you know, decreasing our fossil fuel usage and getting away from gas and getting away from propane and oil and our dependent, you know, our energy dependence. And they're moving towards more electric options. But what happens when the power goes down?
Right.
And so I believe that generators are going to be even more important in the future for sustainable energy. We're all probably going to have generators in the future.
Interesting.
So why wait?
Right. Why not jump on that train now? So as we talk about the big story, which is yet another storm coming our way, we are expecting a lot of power outages. We're expecting a lot of flooding across Connecticut. We want to talk about protecting our homes. And so we have Amanda here with Tri-City, and we'll give you their contact information, everything you need to know at the end of this segment. Amanda, my question, you know, is sort of away from what will come maybe in the next 24 hours for people. It's more of the everyday, the day-to-day when you notice something going on in your bathrooms or your kitchen, for example. How important is it that we are ahead of schedule? So let's say we're going into this storm. We feel pretty good. You know, like a couple storms ago, I felt pretty good about our house. But I did know that we had kind of maybe some valve issues, or we had some lingering issues with the toilet running, or we had a pipe that kind of leaked a little bit in my son's bathroom. We never addressed it. And now here we are. We're kind of in a situation where we're playing cleanup now. How important is it that people are taking note of some of those things, even in the off season, and investing in good plumbing and making sure that everything is to the best standard it can be during these storms?
I don't know about you, Melissa, but in the past couple of years, I have spent so much more time in my home. And, you know, I think we've all kind of become a little bit more of homebodies, even some of us that were like extroverted before, you know, our world changed. And so I feel like it's so important to protect your home. My home is my biggest investment. I'm sure yours is too. And, you know, so it's important. I mean, you can tell us how important it is. You're cleaning up the mess right now.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to say this, but I'm sure you heard that toilet running for a long time.
I did.
And it's probably haunting you that
we never called.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, you get busy. It's like the same thing as like when you hear that noise when you're driving your car. Every time you take a left, it clunks and you're like, I'm just going to turn up the music and I'm just not
right.
Gonna,
right.
You know, and then
your
car breaks down
happens.
On the side of the highway.
Right.
It's like, you know, that valve could have been fixed. I don't want to kick you when you're down. Like,
no, it's okay.
You know, but
no, but I think we're making the point, though. But that's the whole thing is exactly that. I mean, and if anything, I'm so glad that that's the only thing that busted on us, because I do have two or three more items that I know as soon as we get
check
things
them
back,
off the list.
Exactly.
You know, we have these plans. We have a lifetime comfort plan. And our customers join. It's a monthly program. And if you're a part of this club, it's a Lifetime Comfort Club, you are a VIP customer and you never pay for a trip charge. So what that means is that if you have these little items and you're part of our club, it doesn't cost you anything to have someone come out and give you a quote on what it's going to cost to fix it. And you also, with our plumbing plan, you receive a free plumbing inspection annually. So you would be made aware of some of those potential things. And then you would have the option to
go forward or not.
Yeah, and they receive a discount. Lifetime Comfort Club members get a discount on all our services as well.
Wow, that's why everybody loves you. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So if people want to contact Tri-City, I know obviously we were in the midst of a very busy season. We've got this storm coming, but if people wanted to connect with you guys.
We'll get out there. We have a full staff and we're here to help. So tricityappliance.com is our website. You can give us a call, 203-874-8279. We're standing by.
That's excellent. Amanda, thank you so much. I think you shared a lot of really great information.
Thanks, Melissa.
Going into the storm, into the winter, and just
hopefully
the rest of the
year. It won't be that bad. Hopefully. It's just going to be, you know, a couple inches of rain and we don't get a huge washout. But I think people who live in this area, we've been dealing with flooding and water for a long time. And a lot of us know, you know, we've kind of developed little contingency plans on what we do when a storm's coming. And, you know, if those don't work out and people in the community have, you know, a situation they need cleaned up or you have a sump pump that fails, you know, give us a call.
Yeah, certainly. And again, Amanda, thank you so much. And your whole team at Tri-City, we so appreciate it. Hopefully you weather the storm fine. And I know I'll be seeing you guys very soon. So thank you.
I got Steve on run.
Thanks,
speed
Melissa.
Dial.
Yeah.
Thank you. Give him a call. Steve's the best.
Yeah. You guys are all awesome. Thank you, Amanda. I appreciate you.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Again, Tri-City, if you want to check him out online or give him a call, I personally suggest you do that. We actually have this argument a lot. At least me and my friends do. Which is the personality you want to avoid more, the aggressive or the passive aggressive? I always say passive aggressive to me is much harder. I know exactly where I stand with an aggressive person. I kind of feel like I know how to de-escalate a situation if somebody comes at you aggressively. But passive aggressive to me is just infuriating because you're clearly upset about something. You're acting like you're not upset. And then when I react to you, I'm the bad guy, right? Because you came off passive. Why am I talking about this? Because this morning there's a report that we're looking at, recent survey of just over 1,000 Americans talked about these passive-aggressive emails they get or send at work. And the report shows roughly 83% of workers in America say they've received a passive-aggressive email or message at work, and 44% admit that they're the ones being passive-aggressive. So how do we detect a passive-aggressive email, and how do we maybe avoid them in future? Julie Bauke can share that with us for Julie on the Job. Hey, Julie, how are you?
Hey, good.
I mean, so, do you like passive aggressive over aggressive? Like, which do you find is worse?
Let's go up a level first, okay?
Okay.
And the reason why this story really hit me was because I've read similar stories that say that different generations have a different definition of passive aggressive. Like, for instance, and I ran this by my kids who are in their 20s. So a thumbs up emoji is considered passive aggressive by younger people. A dot, dot, dot at the end of a text, not dot, dot, dot. I'm still typing, but dot, dot, dot. So there's,
Wait a minute. So I do think that the dot, dot, dot thing makes me so uneasy. I've had this conversation with Paul Pacelli, our afternoon host, who's in his, I believe he just cracked the 60 mark, but he's a boomer. And when I'm like, hey, can you do that? Do you want to come on at this time? Or do you want to do this? Or did you already do the story? He'll be like, yes, dot, 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 or fine, dot, dot, dot. And I'm like, oh man, he's mad. And I always think that. I'm always like, what? And I've actually said to him, I've addressed it. I'm like, what's with the dot, dot, dot? And he laughed. He's like, that's just like a very casual, like, yeah. It, sure. He's like, I don't know. That doesn't mean anything. I'm like, oh, you're not mad? He's like, no. I'm like, I can't read you via text message. He thought I was crazy when I said that. He thought I was crazy. But I thought that was passive aggressive. Yeah. Tell me another one.
Another one that supposedly is passive aggressive is just K, the letter K.
Yeah.
Like, hey, can you pick up a gallon of milk on the way home?
It is. Okay? I'm sorry. It is passive aggressive.
Oh, my God.
I can feel the steam through the phone.
On the phone.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
What if it's just, okay, I'll pick up a gallon of milk? I think we're so sensitive. No?
I just feel like, aren't we like great communicators out there? I just think when we shorten.
No, we're not. We don't.
No.
We aren't.
I mean, that's true. I mean, it is true, though, Julie. I think to myself, I work in the sector of good communication, and yet that's a breakdown here. So that's true. In the real world, there's the, yeah. you know, we're not great communicators.
So here's the problem is we don't have context. Texting, emails, any of the conversation or the words we share without context, without tone, without facial expressions are always open to misinterpretation. And so instead of walking around and being butthurt all the time by perceived slights, why don't we assume no ill intent or follow up like you did and say, you know, is everything okay? You know, are we okay on this? You know, please tell me if we're not, if you need me to do something different. In other words, don't immediately default to, well, you hurt my feelings.
Exactly.
Because you gave
yes.
me a thumbs up emoji. Come on.
I've never heard the thumbs up emoji. I have to be honest. Honestly, though, Julie, the K thing, though, does drive me nuts. It's like, is it really that hard to say, okay, come on.
just how about got it? Will do.
Right. Okay. Especially if you're having a conversation with somebody, like the only ones I'll give a pass to is like if I know you're super busy. Like when my husband's working and he's in the middle of work and I'm like, hey, don't forget to grab eggs on the way home. Okay. I know it's because he's working. But if I'm having an active conversation with somebody and they just answer okay, it's like, wait, come on. Can't say okay.
Yeah. I mean, again, it depends on the context. Has it been
true.
A heated conversation? Has it been?
That's true.
Is it possible? You know what I mean? I mean, I think you've got to look at context. And I think it's just a recipe for a happier, healthier life if you don't go around assuming you're being offended all the time.
That's very true.
And
yes.
You know, right? I mean,
are you mad? Are you frustrated, Julie Balky,
yeah.
would you say?
We're having a generational tiff right now, Melissa.
That's okay.
Also,
I think that's why. This is why I'm glad that we're talking about this. See, this is the point, is, you know, we've got to talk this through.
Right. So if I say, you know, and this report, it says things like, saying things like, per my last email, is passive aggressive. Okay, so let's talk about that. That's what this article said. Things like things that imply. Okay, so if I look at this and I think, all right, so let's walk this out. Let's say that you owed me some information by last Friday.
Yeah.
Okay. And here it is Tuesday, and I made it very clear to you a week ago that I absolutely needed that information by Friday, no later. Now it's Tuesday. And I come back to you and I say, Melissa, per my last email, that information, I needed that information by Friday. I'm now on a tight deadline to get that information to the client by end of day. When can I expect this?
Oh, I don't think that's passive aggressive.
See, that's you know what that is? I'll tell you what that is. If you are the receiver of that and you feel that's passive aggressive, I think you're just shrouding the fact that you didn't do your job.
Right. You don't want to take accountability. That's what that, I mean, to me, as yeah. if I ever get an email, and I do, I'll get emails like that just because I'm a million different directions. But when I get it, I feel immediately awful because if anything, you're being really nice. You could absolutely be like, Melissa, I asked you for this on Friday. It's Tuesday. What happened? Like, you could absolutely be that way. I think that's a very nice way of being like, hey, P.S., this is still really important and I need that information. To me, I don't find that passive aggressive. I find that to be actually very
here's
pleasant.
Here's some other phrases. Okay, so here's some other
yeah.
here's some other phrases. Circle back. I want to circle back on that customer issue we talked about. Land the plane. I've never heard that one before.
I've never heard
that.
Land
the plane on this. In other words, let's finish.
Right.
Per my last email. Per my last email, takes the cake is the most passive aggressive phrase
hysterical.
Used in work communication. Followed closely by, correct me if I'm wrong, and as previously mentioned. I don't get it. I don't see it. I think it depends on context.
I think it depends on context, but I also think, Julie, and we should talk about this, there's a huge difference between, to me, texting and emailing. So everything you just said to me, I don't find where that's offensive at all. I think where the texting is a little bit harder for me is that's usually more personal. Like, those are more personal connections. Like, I would never text my bosses. Like, if I did, it's you know, it's like, all right, assignment's done or something. Like, I don't know. I to me, and maybe that's just me. I don't usually text people, I guess, at work. So I think I'm thinking more personal. Like, if I text a friend or if I text somebody who's not involved at work. But everything you just said, I'm not seeing it. I don't get it.
Yeah. So the quote from the media, from the PR agency that did this survey said, per my last email, kind of insinuates that the person is not paying attention to their job. They're not putting in the effort to carefully comb through what is being asked of them.
I see it as whenever I get those emails, hey, Melissa, I know you're doing a million things, but like this one thing also matters. So just a reminder, I need that information.
Yeah. So her suggestion instead was something like, just a gentle reminder.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, Julie, we have to dive into this.
Sorry. I'm having a baby boomer response here.
I'm sure you, and you know what? I don't totally disagree with that. I got to be honest with you. So we're talking about passive aggressive behavior and messaging at the workplace. And I actually think, Julie Bauke, you and I are on the same page when it comes to like the email examples you were giving me. I just really quick. So, I mean, I think I think everybody to a certain extent is sensitive. Just some have more sensitivity than others. At work, I would say my sensitivity is very low because I'm used to being in a news atmosphere. You've got to deal with the punches and people's criticism, and just the news world is rough. So I guess maybe that's why when you're saying these things via email, I'm just thinking, you know, hey, an assignment. You have to get it done. I don't think they're attacking my character or who I am as a person. They're just saying, hey, I need this. You're the only person who can give me this. Please give it to me. I don't look at it as anything more logical than that. It's pretty black and white to me. But maybe on the personal end, for some reason, like with the texting, I've never heard of the thumbs up emoji because I do that all the time. So that's, thank you for telling me that. I didn't know that was passive aggressive. I'm always a thumb upper. But some of those other examples to me, again, I think you're coming back to context is really key. And certainly addressing it if you're not sure if something is passive aggressive or not. So what would you say are good replacements for the passive aggressive nature of some of these emails? And again, Julie just gave us some examples of those passive aggressive phrases. So what does this study suggest you say instead?
Lost it here. So something like this PR person in this article says, just a gentle reminder, or I thought I would bring it to your attention that I've asked you for this three times and you've ignored me every single time. Okay. You know, I mean,
I just feel like that doesn't alert the person at all. Like it just makes it feel like it's not important. Yeah. That doesn't set a good precedent.
So, and I know this one, I think you can tell I'm exasperated by this one. But so what I would tell people is, first of all, what I try to do is I assume positive intent. Like, okay, so like if I, you know, suggest a place for dinner and somebody says, you know, fine, I'm going to assume that that's fine unless, you know, unless there's a history of this person maybe giving me these one word answers, but I just know they're busy. They're just a one word answer texter. Yes, that sushi place is fine. Okay, I'm going to proceed and make a reservation versus you expecting me to know that you're fine meant it really wasn't fine? Because, by the way, why don't I remember that you don't like sushi? I mean, the mental gymnastics that you have to go through to manage other people's language and emotions, I just, you know, I feel like I'm pretty, like, if you tell me it's fine, I'm assuming fine. If you tell me there's no issues, I'm assuming there's no issues. And I know that, I don't know, I don't doubt that there are people who thinks maybe I'm against because I didn't understand that they were upset about this or upset about that. But I personally just kind of expect for you to tell me if you're frustrated with me for some reason, tell me and give me a chance to fix that.
Right.
Whether it be that I've had you stop, like your husband is like, you know, Kay, but you know, Melissa, you have me every week when you go to the grocery store, you forget eggs. And here I am every Tuesday picking up those eggs that you forgot. You know, that's a different situation.
Right.
And then it might be like, hey, Melissa, I've noticed that when you go to the store, you don't get eggs and I end up stopping for it. I really don't mind, but is there a better system that we could use to make a list? Maybe we list things over here on the refrigerator. You know, and so it's going into problem solving mode instead of I'm embarrassed that you called me out because I always forget the eggs or because you didn't get that information to me by Friday. Sometimes when people get really defensive, they go on offense.
Right. Exactly. Well, that's just it. They don't want to take accountability. Right.
You aren't speaking to me nicely. Yeah, really? Oh, God. So, and I know this is generational. I know it. And I am all about kindness and giving people the benefit of the doubt. But I also think that if you believe I'm being passive aggressive by saying fine or okay or K or thumbs up, do I have a history of being passive aggressive with you? Now, do I have a history of hiding my feelings? Is
well,
it possible?
And again,
I'm just busy.
Yeah, I just think, especially if you don't, like, I don't know. I mean, I love the company I work for. But I mean, if you were to tell me how well do I personally know the people I work with, like, I would be lying to you if I told you I know them all very personally. Like, I don't know the names of their children. I don't know what towns they live in. I don't. I mean, I love them all and I respect them. But I don't know them personally enough to know when they send an email like the ones you're describing. I've just never detected them as being a personal attack. Because I guess my mindset is different at work. Like you said, it's context. But like to me, when you're texting somebody who, again, I don't really text people at work. I don't even really find that very professional, quite frankly. I mean, unless it's like we were saying, you're on the move and you've got to really quickly text your boss, hey, I'm going to be late or something, I guess. But I send that stuff through an email. I don't know.
Right.
I feel like that's, I get the passive aggressive that you're saying with like generational, but I also think that maybe that's an issue, is that we're making work too personal. Like to me, work should be something separate.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be bringing your character into it to a certain extent. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy.
That's a great point. And we talk all the time about how the line between work and the rest of our lives is all gone.
Yeah. And, so, and I think that's why the lines are getting blurry.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, so.
Take it.
Yeah. I don't. So
what about the fact we're not in the office anymore? So we can't see people's faces. Are you rolling your eyes at me when you say that?
Yeah.
I think
that's just,
right?
Yeah, I think it's, you're blurring the line. I think so. The other thing too, with this, Julie, such an interesting conversation. We knew this was going to happen. But you know, I think context, I think you hit the nail on the head. When you talk to people, like, so if my mom answered K, I know she's upset because my mom never answers a text message without it being a paragraph. So if she says K, I know she's annoyed by something. So, again, like you said, it's context. But if my boss answered K, I'm going to imagine it's because he's in six meetings. And
right.
And you saw my message. Great. Like, thumbs up. To me, I look at that professionally because that's what the relationship is. But maybe people are making their work relationships too personal. Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah. I think there's got to be, you can be very friendly with your coworkers. You can socialize with them. But there has to be a line. And, you know, we're not so good at that. Some people stay away from personal relationships with their coworkers because they've had a bad experience with this in the past. That's
right.
Why they say, when you're going to date a coworker, be very careful because you still have to see them.
Exactly.
Unless one of you is going to quit your job.
So, see, Julie, we basically agree. I think we basically agree.
I think we got through, right?
We compromised. I think we got there and we communicated about it. That was the number one thing there was, my gosh, if you are insecure about something you're getting at work, go confront the person. You know, hey,
don't even confront. Just say, one of my favorite phrases to start a statement with, something like this is, help me understand. Help me understand. Here's what I'm seeing. Am I misinterpreting this? Is there something that we need to talk about? Help me understand is my favorite phrase because it what you walk in assuming that you don't have all the information. And
your defenses are down. Yeah.
The opposite of going in and, you know, hitting somebody between the eyes. Not
like
literally, of course.
Right. Well, hopefully. Hopefully
we don't
not.
We don't want to encourage violence.
No, we do not. And we're certainly not doing that. Julie on the job.
No.
Julie Balke, we so appreciate this conversation. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
It's certainly something to think about, especially as you're heading into this brand new school year. I know some people will misread even how teachers respond in their emails, and that can fuel a fire between parents and teachers. So it's very important, that context, for sure. So great conversation.